Hi, Larry Kleinman. Welcome again to Cable.
Great to be here, Bill. Thanks for inviting me.
Larry Kleinman co-founded with Cipriano Ferrell, Ramon Ramirez, and others the organization PICUN.
Pineros y Campesinos Unidos del Noroeste in Spanish.
Yes, PICUN, in its 45 years in Oregon, had many successes, became a formidable farm worker union, won several strikes for higher pay and safety measures, also sponsored four and won legislation regarding farm worker housing, work safety, pesticide control, eligibility for driver's licenses, and for Oregon as a sanctuary state, making it the first state in the nation to pass a statewide law stopping state and local police and government from helping federal authorities with immigration enforcement. In addition, PICUN played an important role in winning the ballot initiative that increased Oregon's minimum wage. That important, we had a yearly cost of living adjustment, making Oregon's among the highest minimum wage state in the country. And as it grew, PICUN added a radio station and built affordable housing for farm workers and the immigrant community. PICUN was also delegated to represent PICUN in the Fair Immigration Reform Movement. It's known as FIRM. It's the National Lobby for Immigrant Rights. So Larry, Bill Clinton, George Bush Jr., Obama, Trump with his wall, now Biden, all of them have enlarged the Border Patrol and the rest of the border protection apparatus. But all, including Trump with all of his cruelties, failed to stop the flood of people crossing the border. In fact, over the last couple of years, it amazed me, over 1 million non-citizens crossed the border and settled all over this country. So first, Larry, tell us how and why this very surprising and completely unintended development came to happen.
Yeah, your introduction of all this really poses in sharp relief the fact that immigration and migration is a fact of life in this world, and the United States, for all of its power, is no exception. That it's risen and fallen over the periods you described, but increasingly, as we all read in the media, has had a higher flow, and I believe that's largely driven by climate change, directly and indirectly. One thing that is really remarkable about the last few years compared with other times is that this flow of people previously would seek to enter through whatever legal channels. That's always been true. They're very limited. That's something the American public really doesn't understand, how limited they are. But otherwise would somehow try to enter surreptitiously, usually through the help of a human smuggler, right? That still continues. But in the last few years, we've seen millions of people come to the border, cross over either at the Rio Grande or on a land border, and look for Border Patrol agents to surrender themselves and apply for asylum. And that triggers a different process. There is no capacity to detain all of those folks. We saw the different cages and the military bases and other things that especially the Trump administration attempted to employ, but they quickly were overflowing, right? And so the reason why there is over 1 million folks who are now around the country, having been processed by Border Patrol and released into the population pending their political asylum hearing, is that the simple lack of capacity and maybe the lack of will, and maybe that's a good thing, I gotta say, but it's the lack of will to actually affect some other kind of control at the border. Now, I want to go back to what I said a minute ago. Climate change is the meta driver in this. And to understand the sheer will and risk-taking of folks who come here, I want to offer a statistic to you, Bill, that I just read yesterday. In the last year, 250,000 people traversed the Darien Gap on foot. And this is a roadless area. It's about 75 miles long between Colombia and Panama, one of the most dangerous terrains in the world, jungle and controlled by criminal gangs more recently. 250,000 people traversed that on foot. Now, one has to imagine a level of desperation, and that's also just to say that's thousands of miles from the U.S. border. So those folks then have to continue on through a number of countries just to get to the southern border of the United States. And many of those folks have traveled through many other countries to get to that geographic area. To me, that says everything we need to know about how desperate folks are. And when we unpack why they're desperate, what we find is the effects directly and indirectly of climate change.
Well, let's be more specific. Many of the peasants in Latin America have been displaced by the local powers, either the army or agribusiness, and put on land that's less productive. And climate change, because of the droughts and the heat, lower production to the point where people cannot make a living. And so a lot of the people are peasants who just set off and try and save up a little money and set off on foot for a place where they can work for sufficient funds to stay alive, them and their families. And there were many, many, many of the people who surrendered had kids, which really complicated the problem for Trump. And he played it really badly by caging them and dividing the families.
Exactly.
I don't think the Republicans will do that again. That really ruined them for a lot of people, including Republicans. Anyway, why don't you continue, Jerry?
So the syndrome you describe about the collapse of rural agrarian economies in key micro regions, the highlands of Guatemala, for example, where they grow coffee, is an absolute driver. The increased impacts of mega hurricanes in Central America, which themselves have weakened governments, as which were already weak, and now there's a control by criminal gangs that are increasingly brutal and powerful. So you have countries really barely governable, like Honduras. And then on top of that, the effects of the pandemic. We've read a lot about Haitians coming to the border, and many of the folks coming to the border in recent times have not been coming directly from Haiti. They've been coming from other countries in which they had resettled, including, for example, Chile, where there was a considerable number of Haitians who resettled after the 2010 earthquake in Haiti. But in the pandemic, found the economic circumstances there intolerable. The opportunities that they had had disappeared. And so they were once again migrating to a place of safety. And so all these things have come together to create a flow that we've never seen before. And I'm, from my vantage point, I'm here to say that this is only the beginning of more of this that we're going to see. And so if our conclusion is that we struggle as a nation to deal with the politics that are triggered by this phenomenon, we certainly have the capacity to resettle this number of folks. In fact, we need labor. We can talk about that later. But if we can't deal with this level, we really need to think hard about and try to imagine what it's going to be like when the numbers double, which I believe they may well in a short number of years.
Before we leave this subject, Larry, let's go to what I consider an enormously humorous story of the Venezuelans who DeSantis picked up, not in Florida, but in Texas. He flew them to Charlotte, North Carolina, and then had another flight to Martha's Vineyard. Most of them were Venezuelans. And when they got to Martha's Vineyard and met all of these people who wanted to help, they said, yeah, help us. Get us to Florida. Get us to Florida, right, where we have relatives and have jobs waiting. You told me that story.
Exactly.
No, it's really preposterous. And DeSantis flew people all around the world in order to get to Florida. Yeah.
What puts a sadder and even more exquisite point or finer point on it is some of those same 50 folks that you're describing who ended up at the airport in Martha's Vineyard, didn't even know where they were, right? Ended up, when they finally got to Florida, ended up working in emergency cleanup jobs in the aftermath of Hurricane Ian.
So, Larry, this system is absurd, in fact, in so many ways, of course, and absurd because considering it satisfies no U.S. interest group except perhaps low-wage employers who are very happy with the stream of people who are desperate. But you see it lasting a long time, and it's not going to be replaced soon, regardless of who's in power, Republicans or Democrats. Tell us why.
Well, it's the same political deadlock that we've seen in demagoguery for many years. On so many issues, we see that the country is polarized and the sides are fairly evenly split in terms of voter demographics. So it's a deadlock not easily bridged. And the Republicans in particular are hyper invested in giving no accomplishment, I mean, obstructing every possible accomplishment they can for Biden and the Democrats, even to the point of overriding the interests and the lobby of a powerful group in their ranks, the growers. So agribusiness has been screaming to pass an immigration law that would regularize the status of 1.5 million farm workers or so and create a better system for what's called future flows, workers coming in the future. We were part of those negotiations time back and still are. Our PECWIN's president, Reyna Lopez, is still involved in that process that's ongoing. In any event, it's so that when workers come in the future, they don't simply come contracted for a period of time and only for one employer, but can switch employers and can eventually stay permanently. So that those are big concessions that we've been demanding for decades, and that's in that proposal. Well, interestingly, as powerful as we imagine the agribusiness lobby is, especially among the ranks of Republicans, in the lame duck session we just saw in December, they could not find or move 10 Republicans out of 50, including the 7 Republican senators who were retiring and didn't face political consequences in the future for any action they took. They could not find 10 to break an inevitable filibuster, to move a House bill that would have instituted these reforms for agriculture that had passed in the House twice, including first time 36 Republicans, the second time about 30 Republicans. So it had not inconsiderable Republican support in the House, passed overwhelmingly, and they couldn't even find 10 senators. And to me, that's a real testament to how deep the polarization and the xenophobia and the deny the Democrats any accomplishments by any means is the name of the game. And that's why we have little or no basis to expect that with a Republican House, a narrow majority in the House, a Democratic Senate, also narrow, that won't continue to exist. There is a means, by the way, in the House that they could move a bill without going through the Rules Committee, without going through the Speaker, even. It's called a discharge petition. If 218 members of the House sign a petition saying we want to vote, there has to be a vote within 30 days, unless the Republicans change that rule. They have not so far. It would require a handful of Republicans siding with all the Democrats to move a bill like that, for example. It would force a vote. There would obviously be repercussions against those individuals, and they'd have to think about that, the Republicans. But it's not going to happen, Bill, because everybody knows that there aren't going to be 10 votes in the Senate to break a filibuster there. So it would be a meaningless exercise.
This is Bill Resnick here for the Old Mole, talking to Larry Kleinman, co-founded PECWIN, Oregon's Farm Worker Union and Immigrants' Rights Organization. We've been discussing the how and why more undocumented immigrants are seeking to come to this country and more are making it through untouched by eluding the Border Patrol or by surrendering to them, making claims for asylum, and getting scheduled for asylum hearings. These would be far into the future, but that hearing, scheduling of the hearing, allows them to stay in the U.S., which in turn allows them to hook up with relatives, friends, fellow country people, and get settled to get almost entirely low-wage work. Still, for the immigrants, getting settled and living stably with employment and family and often church supporters, that gives them a leg up in getting permanent status. So, Larry, while the current system could go on for a long time, regardless of who's in power, at some point the tensions will force some sort of resolution what to do on the immigration front. What's your candidate for that point when something will have to be done?
Yeah, that's a great question. I'd make three quick points about it. First is we're seeing a lot of people ask, well, if Congress isn't going to act, why can't the Biden administration use its executive authority? The most well-known example of that in recent times was the DACA program for youth that came to this country before the age of 16. That was an executive order issued by President Obama in 2012. But what we've seen in that realm and other sweeping executive measures is that right-wing attorneys general around the country from the states have filed litigation challenging those as unconstitutional power grabs by the executive of what they contend is legislative authority, meaning if Congress wants that to happen, they'll legislate it. If they don't, the executive branch cannot categorically extend employment authorization and deportation protection to hundreds of thousands or millions of people. So this is working its way through the courts. It's gone up and down. As we remember, Trump tried to cancel it. There was litigation by the Democratic attorneys general. But this is going to come to a head, and it's going to be, I think, a cataclysmic moment for the immigration issue because of all the attention paid to DACA in the last 10 plus years. Now, we'll see the decision in the Supreme Court of an important underlying case this term, this year, 2023. But I don't believe DACA will come to a head in the court until 2024 or possibly 25. But I'm 100% sure it's headed there. The lower courts are going to have ruled against the Obama administration, now the Biden administration. I don't think the Supreme Court majority is going to be receptive, and I think they're going to strike it down as too broad a use of executive authority. And then if our movement does our work, together with many, many institutional allies in business, in academia, in local government, in faith, in labor, in solidarity, in racial justice, we will foment a real cathartic moment as we are all witness to 25,000 young folks, many of them no longer that young, losing their status that they've had for upwards of 10 years every month for the succeeding 2 years as DACA sort of withers. And that's a political moment to try to break through the deadlock and the stonewalling of the Republicans. So it's my call to my counsel to immigrant rights leaders to prepare for that moment as mightily as possible. But the last thing I want to say about it is the larger challenge we have is what I call the fraught politics of welcome. We know millions of people are coming. We know why they're coming in many cases, or in most cases. Our legal system isn't really prepared to handle them, but our economic system badly needs them. We're an aging population. There is not an emerging workforce to care for us, the aged, or the increasingly aged, never mind in 10 years or 20 years. So the worker base of this country is declining, and we need an infusion of workers. So it's a good thing economically and demographically that this is happening. It's a bad thing that it's happening because of all the suffering that it occasions, and it's not well organized. But that, unfortunately, is going to continue. The folks who naturally would most acclaim and applaud this arrival and call for a generous and open welcome, they do that, but the political actors are cowed or afraid, and with some good reason, I think, of the reaction of the xenophobes and the white supremacists, who, of course, characterize this as an invasion of non-white folks who are going to only hasten the day that white folks become a minority in what they regard as a white entitlement or white supremacist claim to culture and government power. And so to sort of avoid that, otherwise pro-immigration actors are really undervoiced or silent about that welcome. And so as opposed to being full-throated and sort of engaging the debate fully, frontally, and attempting to persuade the American people that this is really both a fulfillment of American values, of refuge on the one hand, and a good thing economically in terms of jobs and the economy on the other.
Yeah, I think that there's no doubt that when DACA comes down and ends the dreamer's dream, all of those folks, and with support from the movements, will gain a great audience. There'll be a great furor. My sense is that the kind of movement that you're discussing, that is the importance and, in fact, necessity of having more people in the workforce who are ready to work and at decent wages, that set of ideas is extremely important. And even if, in fact, it doesn't carry the day and somehow the Congress squeezes out some much lesser reform, trying to satisfy the dreamers a little bit, whatever it is, some kind of compromise, there's no doubt that would happen. But another crisis is coming up. It can't be estimated what year it will be, but the climate crisis is certainly on its way. People are already feeling it in many countries of the world. Here, the concern is growing and growing and growing. Climate change denial is a dead letter. It seems to me when the crisis really starts in the United States, with food prices spiking, with areas of the country triaged so that the state and the country can no longer afford to repair the infrastructure that's getting destroyed by the huge storms or the great droughts that are on its way. And Phoenix is already now talking about forbidding any further growth. They're running out of water and don't know what to do. When it really strikes hard in the United States, my sense is that the corporate people are going to be angling to take control of the response, which would be a disaster. Their program is just a list of fantasy technologies and slow replacement of coal and oil. It will never work. The left program, though, does work. And my sense is that the left program would be an all-hands-on-board program. We need all of the people we can get, in fact, all over the world, to rebuild our economies and transform the energy system and the transportation system, our agricultural production. Anyway, my sense is that the all-hands-on-board left program would contain not just a welcome, but incentives for rebuilding our industrial structure, which would take a huge number of workers, and rebuilding our transportation system and the rest of it. Anyway, we're out of time. I've been talking to Larry Kleinman, who co-founded Pecun, an enormously successful farm and worker protection group, especially Hispanic, mostly undocumented workers. We discussed why over 1 million people, mostly Hispanic, have crossed the border in recent years, even the Trump years, and settled in the U.S., and why that system is likely to last for a significant amount of time, but will ultimately fail in one or another national crisis. For me, it's the looming climate crisis, with both the left and our corporate friends now in struggle to determine who gets the authority and resources to plan and direct the response, and God help us if the corporate Goliath wins that battle. But if the left prevails, it'll be all hands on board across the world, in fact, with good jobs for all and into the future, if there is a future. Larry, you get the last word.
I appreciate that frame, and just say that part of that, I'm sure 90%+ of the folks coming to our border now really would rather stay home, right? As would we if we were in their position, but they can't. So part of our climate response is finding places in the world, first and foremost in their own countries, but nearby, if not, where they can achieve what you just described, a sustainable lifestyle. That's the more global kind of universal vision as well, that it's not simply immigration is the only response. So it's kind of yes and immigration and repair and adaptation in the sending localities.
Larry Kleinman, thanks a lot for talking to us today.
My pleasure, Bill. Anytime.